Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to this week's Living Torah. And I just got back in last night. Actually, last week I took off and I had a trip I needed to take to Florida to do some personal business for my mother. And so I tied that in with a couple of meetings up in one of them in South North Carolina. Did not know that North Carolina and Georgia actually shared a border, but I do now. And in around the Atlanta area. And so these are things we could not put on our internet, on our website, just because of the space. We didn't have enough room. And I'm finding that's happening more and more right now, is I'm doing a lot of home groups. And in these small groups, they're just not, it's just not possible to just open it up for everyone. Good news is, in both those places, that I'm working on doing some larger events in the next couple of months. And so there'll be some information out about that. So I was up in North Carolina, in Georgia, on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Went down to Jacksonville and took care of some things for my mother. Probably going to have to go back again and do a little bit more. But I left, let's see, today's Thursday. I left Tuesday afternoon late to get into Dothan and then drove from Dothan to Oklahoma yesterday. So a little bit over 800 miles. So that's if I just kind of look a little blank at times, that's the reason. All right, I guess the major news this weekend for Memorial Day weekend is the Pope is in Israel, and it's reported, and of course the secrecy and things that go on behind the scenes with the Vatican and all this is who's going to really know the truth? But he's going to Jordan first. Now, why would he go to Jordan first? To meet with the leaders of Jordan is because the country of Jordan actually controls the Temple Mount. And here we see, not sure exactly how this is going to play out, because as Maimonides said, no one knows what is to be until it is. But I think the prophetic nature of this is very, very loud, is speaking really loud right now. It's also reported that they may be giving the Catholic Church the area of David's, what is reported to be David's tomb. Now, I don't believe, I have a problem with that. David's tomb in a section, it's actually Mount Zion of Jerusalem. It, to me, it just never has felt right when I've gone in there. You know, it's like the Church of the Unholy Sepulcher is what I call it. It has this religious feel to it. And David's tomb has the same kind of religious feel. Now, the other thing that's important about this site is that is the area that is believed to be the place of the Last Supper. Now, this is Mount Zion. Whether it was there or not, you know, you tell people enough times that something is true and it becomes true in their mind, whether it is true or not. So just the fact that they might be giving this area over to the Catholic Church, once again, some things happening. We're just going to have to hold on with the ride and see what happens. Well, with that, we're going to get into the scriptures and we're going to go to Matthew chapter 27. You know, up until this point, these things are happening. These things that are happening of Judas going out and selling Messiah for a number of coins and then going to the Mount of Olives and coming back across the Kidron and the beatings and the whip, all of these things happening, there are people that say, well, this is just a man who got caught up in the political structure of that day. He was a good teacher, and he just kind of went too far, made some enemies, and eventually got caught up in the whole thing, and he died and started a new religion. You know, kind of like Joseph Smith was probably would not be that famous had he not been actually killed in the midst of the birthing of Mormonism. Same is true with Muhammad. So, you know, once again, it just Yeshua just kind of got involved in this, and he died, and he began a new religion. This is what is taught. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, because we go back into the scriptures. And we find that there are over 300 prophecies that tell where Messiah would be born and how he would die. Literally, a crucifixion, an execution on a stake, on a tree, is when Isaiah, I believe it is speaking about this, and we'll get into those scriptures here as we continue on. This type of a death had not been dreamed up yet. It was not even thought of. And so the very fact that it could be written about how he would die, and then, you know, all of a sudden get caught up in something and live it out in such a way that as he's walking along to Calvary, to the execution stake, that he's planning these events out, I think is absolutely absurd. And so we actually go over to the book of Acts, and these guys knew this. You know, they were probably having to deal with some of the things that we deal with today, in that there was a group of religious leaders there, and they are they're saying, well, you know, you guys just made all this stuff up. And so in the book of Acts, chapter 2, if I can get my fingers to work this morning, too much drive time, I guess. In Acts chapter 2, starting in verse 22, it says, "Men of Israel, listen to this. Yeshua from Nazareth was a man demonstrated to you to have been from God by the powerful works, miracles, and signs that God performed through him in your presence. You know yourself this." Now, let's just stop right there. I don't know how many hours I spent on the phone. Thankfully, I have the new AT&T plan that I have unlimited calling. I spent hours on the phone yesterday with people going through all kinds of different things. Two of those conversations had to do with this, once again, ugly rising of a head of the argument that Yeshua is not Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in the flesh. And those of you that know my background and some of the things that I've been through, you know that I fight for that, vehemently fight for that. Well, here is a verse that some will take out of context, not knowing who these people are that are speaking right here, and say, well, you know, it says that he was a man demonstrated to have been from God by the powerful works, miracles, and signs that God performed through him. Well, he's speaking to a group of religious leaders who already have their doctrines in line of who the Messiah is going to be. We talked about this months ago, probably, that they believed that there would be specific signs that only the Messiah would be able to do. The cleansing of a leper, and I think giving sight and raising the dead. There was one more in there. I'd have to go back into those notes. But they're saying to these people, you know, this is what you were looking for, and Yeshua is the person that fulfilled it right before you. Well, it's also taught, Judaism taught thousands of years ago, prior to the time of the Masoretes and the Talmud and all of these things, that Messiah would be Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Okay, they did not believe. There was, of course, you know, there's always groups that believe different things. But the writings of Judaism said that Yeshua, that Messiah would be Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in the flesh. And we're going to see how that kind of lines out in the coming weeks here, of how accurately, what detail that the Father went through to show this glaring right in front of these people's eyes, but they refused to accept it. Now, in verse 23, the man was arrested in accordance with God's predetermined plan and foreknowledge. This was not happenstance. The scripture is very clear. Messiah was slain before the foundations of the earth. That the Almighty could look forward in history, and he could see what man would do. He could see the fall of Adam and Eve. He could see the things that man was going, he could see our own sin, the things that you and I are guilty of. And he said, I'm going to make a way for them to be redeemed. And so it says the predetermined plan and foreknowledge. These things do not catch the Almighty off guard. He's not sitting up in the heavens wringing his hands and saying, what do I possibly do next? No. The plan that has been in effect for over 4,000 years is being manifested in front of his eyes. It says, though the agency of persons not man, let me just read the whole thing. This man was arrested in accordance with God's predetermined plan and foreknowledge. And through the agency of persons not bound by the Torah, you nailed him on a stake and killed him. You know, it was scribes and the Pharisees, the religious leaders, we didn't do it. It was Rome that did it. You know, we didn't have any control over this thing that happened. You know, Yeshua just got caught up in it, and here we are, and we're kind of innocent bystanders in this, all just watching as he is being put to death. And it is said right here, you are the one that nailed him to that stake and killed him. They are not, Peter is not going to let them off the hook. We go over to Acts chapter 3 and verse 18. And it says, but this is how God fulfilled what he had announced in advance when he spoke through all the prophets, namely that his Messiah was to die. Go all the way back. Let's just do that just because we can. Let's go all the way back to Genesis, something that most of you know very, very well. The gospel in the genealogy in Genesis chapter 5. Let's read how that lines out. If we take the, for those that are unfamiliar with this maybe, if we take the names that are in the genealogy and those names mean something, and we put them into a sentence, here's the sentence. Man is appointed to mortal sorrow, but the blessed Elohim shall come down. The blessed Elohim shall come down, teaching that his death shall bring the despairing comfort. It is prophesied in the writings, in the prophets, that it would be Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh himself that would come and would give his life as a ransom for many. And of course, you know, the legalities of that and the divorce and all of these things. You can, I know that that Eddie Chumney right now is doing some work on that. And so, and I've heard a little bit about what he is doing. He's talking about the marriage contract and the adultery and all of these things and the reasons for Messiah dying. So you can go to his website. It's Hebrews, Hebrots. Type in Eddie Chumney. I think he's the only one that comes up. Maybe you want to look into the series that he is doing. I plan on doing the same thing myself. So this is not taking anybody by surprise except for one man. There's one man that this thing is just all of a sudden placed on his shoulders. And we read this in Matthew chapter 27, verse 32. And this is really as far as we're going to get this week, is this one verse right here. As they were leaving. Now, Messiah has been through the flogging. He has gone and the soldiers have played out their king for the day. And now it is time for that one who is the king, as has been done so many times by the Roman soldiers. It is now time for him to die. They have mocked him. They have spit upon him. They have slapped him. They have done everything that they could to him. And now it's time for him to be taken to a stake. And so they would have put a crossbeam over him and would have led him off unto the stake. I want to go to right here before, maybe a little bit of an awkward transition, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to go to, and I've never done this on camera, a book that I've been using as a bit of a reference by Chuck Swindoll. And I mentioned this to you a number of weeks ago. It's called The Darkness and the Dawn. And so before we actually get into, over the next 2 or 3 weeks, the details of these specific scriptures, I'd like to go to Chuck Swindoll's book and actually just read to you a section of this in it's difficult to get through to begin with, but I want to try to go through it, because I believe that he actually brings out, and he's using different references of different people, but he is bringing out what we're going to study over the next few weeks. I think it's probably maybe a good time to just read this, kind of get the setting in your mind, so that when we begin to go through it, you can reference back to this. This is the references from a man named Jim Bishop, and is a vivid and lengthy description of a crucifixion in the day of Messiah. So I'm just going to take a few minutes and read this. It said, the executioner laid the cross beam behind Yeshua, and this is actually getting to the place where, as I said, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I think it's very important for us to see where we're going, and that he would have he would not have had this 8-foot cross, you know, the like Arthur Blessed had carried around the world years ago. It would not have been a huge beam with a beam across it, but instead they had specific places in Israel. The Romans had set this up, because this was all done public. This was they wanted the maximum public exposure on this, to put fear into the people. This was a fear that was generated that made Nazi Germany look like a playground for children. The fear that the Romans were trying to keep the Jews living under, and so they had these places of the crucifixions. And it would have literally been a tree stump. Many believe that it was an olive tree stump, and you know, prophetic implications there, that would have just been there, maybe 5 feet tall, just about the height, not way up there in the air in some romantic, the old rugged cross kind of a song. But a stump that was right on the highway, so that everyone going along that road, and understand it's Passover, the number of people that are there in the city, it looks like it is the tourist season in Israel. And so here we see that they would have taken him, and they would have attached this beam, probably a 4x4, cut out, a rough cut, about a 4x4 or something like this, maybe 5 or 6 feet long, and they would have, this is what he would have carried. So when it says, take up my cross, and those are scriptures we'll get to in a moment, take up your cross and follow me, it is actually the beam that he is speaking of. But more important is the message of, when you took up that beam, where were you going? You were not going to a party. You were not going to some kind of an event. You were going to your death. So when Yeshua says to the disciples, back in the book of Matthew, he says, take up your stake. Take up your beam, your execution stake, and follow me. That would have been something that was so outrageous for these people to hear. They could not even comprehend it. It's like us saying, take up your electric chair and follow me. And you, why? I mean, just that would just kind of, your mind would go tilt in the midst of that. And so here we see that Yeshua has been betrayed. He is in probably the greatest pain that he has gone through has not been the physical. It has been the emotional part, that everyone has deserted him. He literally has nobody there. Peter is following at a distance. His mother, Yochanan, they are there somewhere, but he's by himself in the midst of this thing. And so we see that he has this beam attached to his back, and I'm going to pick it up, and we're going to go to what's going to be in a couple weeks, just to give you the idea of what is happening, what's transpiring, what he knows is about to happen. Yeshua has seen this happen before. Okay, this is not the first execution in Israel. This was a common event. It said that thousands of people were put to death in that day. And so Yeshua, he has seen. He has seen the horrific death. He knows what is ahead of him. I mean, talk about fear. When you're walking out something, and you know, it's like if you were kidnapped by a group of thugs. Your mind, you know, this is not going to be good. And if you had just listened on the radio or watched on the television the night before, and the last person that was that was kidnapped in your area, they had given in detail the way the person was killed the night before, and now here you are with the same person, the same kidnappers, and all of those things that you heard about the night before, that's all going through your mind. The difference is that at any moment, Yeshua could have called legions of angels and it would have been all over. Love. Talked about that last week. Love. Love conquered fear. Love conquered what was ahead. Love conquered everything. Love covers a multitude of sins. In the time of Yeshua, as he's walking, the love, the joy that is set before him, covering everything. Well, I got to get into this. This is going to be hard. The executioner laid the crossbeam behind Yeshua and brought him to the ground quickly by grasping his arm and pulling him backward. As soon as he fell, the beam was fitted under the back of the neck and on each side. Soldiers quickly knelt on the inside of the elbows. Once begun, the matter was done quickly and efficiently. The executioner wore an apron with pockets. He placed 2 5-inch nails between his teeth and hammer in hand, knelt beside the right arm. The soldier, whose knee rested on the inside of the elbow, held the forearm flat to the board. With his right hand, the executioner probed the wrist of Yeshua to find the little hollow spot where there would be no vital artery or vein. When he found it, he took one of the square-cut iron nails from his teeth, held it against the spot directly behind where the so-called lifeline ends. When he raised the hammer over the nail head and brought it down with force, the executioner jumps across the body to the other wrist. As soon as he was satisfied that the condemned man could not, in struggling, pull himself loose and perhaps fall forward off of the stake, he brought both his arms upward rapidly. This was the signal to lift the crossbeam. 2 soldiers grabbed each side of the crossbeam and lifted. As they pulled up, they dragged Yeshua by the wrists. When the soldiers reached the upright, the 4 of them began to lift the crossbeam higher until the feet of Yeshua were off the ground. The body must have writhed in pain. When the crossbeam was set firmly, the executioner reached up, set the board which listed the name of the prisoner and the crime. We'll get to that in a few weeks. Then he knelt down before the stake. 2 soldiers hurried to help, and each one took hold of a leg at the calf. The ritual was to nail the right foot over the left, and this was probably the most difficult part of the work. If the feet were pulled downward and nailed close to the foot of the cross, the prisoner always died quickly. Over the years, the Romans learned to push the feet upward on the cross. so the condemned man could lean on the nails so as to stretch himself upward. Some historians describe a saddle-like piece of wood on the upright pole where the victim could rest the base of his pelvis and find relief. His arms were now in a V position, and Yeshua became conscious of two unendurable circumstances. The first was that the pain in his wrist was beyond bearing, and that muscle cramps knotted his forearms and upper arms and the pads of his shoulders. The second was his pectoral muscles at the side of his chest were momentarily paralyzed. This induced in him an involuntary panic, for he found that while he could draw air into his lungs, he was powerless to exhale. To be able to keep breathing, the victim on the cross had to stay in constant motion. So he literally dragged himself up and down, constantly so as to make breathing possible. Eventually, he could no longer lift himself sufficiently to continue breathing. With each second, the pain mounted. His arms, his legs, his entire torso screamed with pain. The nerves were pulled tightly like strings of a violin across a bridge. Slowly and steadily, he was asphyxiated, as though two thumbs were pressing against his throat. Some suggest that victims of crucifixion died of suffocation. Others teach that they died from hunger. Still others maintain that they died from sheer exhaustion. As the body eventually wore out from the unendurable pain and the unnatural suspension of the organs and muscles, one person summarizes, few more terrible means of execution could be devised. Pain, thirst, the torture of insects, exposure to brutal spectators, the horror of rigid fixation, and all continuing interminably, combined to make it a supreme humiliation and torture. This is what the road in front of Yeshua looks like. And in the scriptures it says, as they were leaving, they met a man from Cyrene named Simeon, and they forced him to carry Yeshua's execution stake. Now, this is in the other Gospels. I'm going to stick specifically to Matthew. Who is this guy? He is from Cyrene, which is a section of Africa. His name is Shimon. Probably he is from the... possibly at least, he is part of the diaspora. He is part of the northern tribes that would have gone down to Africa. This is a man who is black in color. He is darker skinned than even those that are there in the city. We do not know much about, we don't know anything really about him. He was a Hebrew. At least we figure from his name, Shimon. He was a Hebrew. It is the time of the Passover. It is possible to insert in here. It's possible that this man could have saved all of his life in order to make a trip for Passover. This could, for him, could have been a once in a lifetime event. We just do not know. The streets of Jerusalem are clogged with people. And this man, the excitement of being in Jerusalem, maybe for the first time for a Passover, and he gets caught up. The worst possible thing that could have happened in that day as you were in Jerusalem would have been to feel the cold steel of a Roman sword as you were being tapped on the shoulder, and you dare not just leave and walk off because you may be next in line. You may be another one. They build another execution stake for you. As I said, this made Nazi Germany look like a playground. And so as this man is walking in the midst of this crowd of people, all of a sudden he is confronted with a Roman soldier walking toward him, two on each side, one on each side, and this man in the center, Yeshua, being led with these other two criminals to a hill called Golgotha. As he's there, Yeshua stumbles. And Simon, Shimon's life is forever to change at that moment. It is the utmost in God opening his appointment calendar and saying, I've got one person down there in that crowd that has that I can see has a heart toward me, and the extreme that he went to reach out to that man. We're not told specifically, but it appears that his life actually did change, because we see over in Acts chapter 13, in the Antioch congregation were prophets and teachers: Barnabas, Shimon, known as the Black, Lucius from Cyrene. So maybe this had been a group of people that came from this area of Cyrene and came to Jerusalem for the Passover. But it is Shimon who is tapped on the shoulder. And there's two aspects of this that I want to try my best. I've thought about these verses for weeks and weeks and weeks. This one verse, I've thought about this for weeks in knowing I was going to get here, and I hope I can do it some justice. There's two aspects of this that I'd like to bring out. Is, first of all, Simeon, Shimon. This is a man that his life is to forever change because of an event. He didn't wake up that morning thinking, you know, I think I'll go walk out in Jerusalem and I'll get in the middle of that crucifixion that's going to happen tonight. And no, it didn't go like that. In fact, he woke up that morning, and in his mind, everything is about Passover. Everything is about getting to the meal. Everything is about that tonight I'm going to be able to taste a piece of lamb, a Passover lamb. Instead of eating a meal, he came face to face with the Passover lamb. His life was forever changed in that moment. Now, Simeon, Shimon could have just acted in anger when that Roman soldier tapped him on the shoulder with the sword and said, you, get that stake, get that beam, put it on your shoulders, follow us. You know, he could have, the choice to not do that was, would have been something he would have thought about it for a moment. I'd just run. He knew he wouldn't be running far. Instead, he reaches down, he takes it. He could have, with indignation, with anger, with rebellion in his heart, he could have, I'll take it and then get there and just throw it down on the ground. But it doesn't appear that that's to be what happened. I really, this is one of those people in eternity I want to meet. I want to know more about this account than what is here in the scriptures. For he, fulfilling the words, Yeshua said, take up your cross and follow me. This man took that to the extreme that day, as he took up Messiah's cross. He helped with the beam of Messiah, and he went with him to Golgotha. And it is looks apparent in the scriptures that the words, take up your cross and follow me, die to yourself, it appears that that actually happened in the life of Simone, because we see him later on in the book of Acts, and there's another reference or two I didn't bring out, that it looks like this is the man that is there. The extreme place that Messiah will, that the Creator will go to through Messiah in order to bring us back to relationship with Him. The other side of this is probably, I think, maybe one of the most difficult concepts that I have ever tried to work through, to think through. Yesterday, as I was driving, I had a lot of time. I was on the phone, as I said, but I also had a lot of time just to stare through the windshield. And I thought about this verse so many times, that if there are legions of angels around, and yes, there are, at any moment, Messiah could have summoned them to save Him. He could have also summoned them to help Him. For the one who is the creator of the universe, the one who in the garden was walking with Adam and Eve, the one who on that day of Passover 4,000 years earlier had gone out into His creation and slaughtered one of His creation so that Adam and Eve could have hope of redemption, that same one could have summoned an angel to help Him. For the load of the stake, the load of sin, and to think that I understand what I am about to say, not any more than you do. The load of the cross, the load of the sin upon that cross, the sin upon that beam was too much for Him to bear. The weight of it drove Him to the ground. And instead of calling for a legion of angels, He called for a man. A man like you and I. A man of flesh and blood. He said, come alongside of me and help me with this mission. The mission is to get to the stake, is to get to the tree, because it is on that tree that the culmination of the covenant will be ratified. The steps of a biblical covenant that I've taught on is the messages on my website. All of those steps have been put in place, from the receiving the code of righteousness to eating the memorial meal. But it has not been completed, because it is the shedding of blood upon a tree that fulfills the completion of that covenant. And Messiah looks at a person and says, help me. I can't make it there on my own. It's pretty clear to me, if the God of the universe, if the one who created the universe needed help in this world, how much more are you and I going to need help? Just me and God, we can do it. I've heard that so many times through the years. It's sickening. That God calls us. He calls us to walk together. You shall love Yahweh your Elohim with all your heart, soul, and strength. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Those are two commandments about relationship, about coming together. Israel is about coming together as a community, not walking it out as the lone ranger. If there's anything that I see today that the enemy is fighting, the conversations I had yesterday on the phone, all about relationship. The enemy is working overtime to make us stumble on our way. I mean, we are a people. We should be a people that have accepted that call to take up that stake and to follow Him. If Messiah could not make it on His own, what makes us think we're going to? What makes us think we're going to do it on our own if He couldn't do it on His own? He could have. Okay, He could have. But He gave us an example right there. I feel like I'm falling so short on this right now. He gave us an example that if you and I are going to make it to that joy that is set before us, it is going to be with the help of others. It is going to be that we walk out a relationship with Him and we walk out a relationship with others. I know many today that are struggling with the relationship. Don't let the enemy win. Don't let the enemy win. Because if you and I allow the enemy to win, then it means that we're the ones that are going to come up short. Not making it to the promise. Not making it to the promise of the fulfillment, taking up that cross and following Him. Dying to self so that we can live unto Him. Isn't that what it's about? Yeshua died unto Himself so that He could be life to us. Our walking to the stake is dying to ourself so that we can walk unto Him. We can walk for Him. We can walk with Him. We can walk in Him. Whatever you want to describe it there. But in order for us to see the fulfillment, the fullness of the purpose that you and I were created in, and that is to be His disciples, in order to get there, we've got to go to that stake first. I dare say we're not there yet. Maybe it is that we're getting close. And the reason that the enemy is fighting so hard is because we're getting close to that that you and I have been crying out for years. To give our lives completely to Him. So that we may be those people upon this earth that He has called us to be, to shine forth His incredible light and glory. Well, I'm out of time. I don't know if how I said that made sense. It is only because of His anointing. I just think about it. Think about it. If He stopped and needed help to get to His destination, how much more are we going to need help to get to ours? Well, with that, Shavuot Tov. I pray you have a wonderful, blessed, and prosperous in Him week. And Bezrat Hashem, God willing, see you again next week. Yivarechecha Adonai.
v'yishmarecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yichunecha. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom.